Do you like those real estate shows on cable TV, you know, House Hunters or House Hunters International? My wife loves those shows. She likes to look at other people's houses, and I find it a little dull most of the time. I think maybe she's trying to tell me something. Maybe I'm in for getting a new house myself. But if you like those kind of shows, you're in for a real treat today, because we're looking at a house ourselves today. We're going on a tour of a house, but this one I find interesting. This one is the historic home of John Marshall, one of the most important figures in American constitutional history. In fact, the greatest Chief Justice in the history of the United States. Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation, Virginia, is taking me on a private tour. And I should say, this is part two of that tour. And so if you haven't heard part one, and if you're listening to the podcast, you might want to go and start with part one first. But if you're in your car, settle back and listen, and we'll bring you up to date. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about John Marshall House.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
This is part two of our tour of John Marshall House in Richmond, Virginia, the historic home of the greatest Chief Justice in the history of the United States, John Marshall. I'm in the middle of a tour with Jennifer Hurst Wender of a group called Preservation Virginia, which appropriately enough preserves, protects, and defends a number of structures in the Commonwealth, including John Marshall's house right in downtown Richmond. Now, in part one of this, Jen told me about how Preservation Virginia came to be in possession of John Marshall House. We went through several of the rooms, but we only got about halfway through when we had to call it to a halt. The tyranny of the clock once again struck. But now we're going to pick up with our tour and finish it up today. Here's Jennifer Hurst Wender.
This is the large dining room. And we call it the large dining room because it's the largest room in the house. And we know that this was the room where Marshall would hold what he called lawyer's dinners. And the lawyer's dinners would be, when he was in Richmond, he would invite about 30 of the most prominent people in Richmond at the time. They didn't have to live there. If they were coming in for a court case or whatever they were visiting, he would invite them to his house to have dinner, and he would do this once a month.
Wow.
And in true Marshall fashion, it would be a 7-course meal. You would have Madeira and other spirits served liberally the entire time. Mm-hmm. And it would go pretty much probably until the sun rose the next morning.
Good grief. So he was a party animal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I think that this is a very similar style to, it's an American version of what the French did with their salons, where they were inviting people to have discourse. Mm-hmm. This is such a pivotal time, which the formation period of our government. So inviting these people to his house to not speak on the record, mm-hmm. but to just get those ideas out there, I think was pretty influential on what Marshall was doing.
Very nice.
So that's why we call this the large dining room. But it's by far the largest room in this house, and so this would have been where dances would have taken place. Right outside that window is where the law office would have been.
Right.
Right where the court's building starts is mm-hmm. pretty much so.
This is a pretty big room. It's probably 25 or 30 feet one way and then maybe a little bit more the other way. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fairly large room. You could fit 50 or 60 people in here. If you needed to. I mean, it'd be a little bit crowded then.
Right. Well,
you certainly could have 20 or 30 to dinner if you set up a couple of tables.
Right, and he would do it diagonally. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one in the table here, one and stretch it all the way to the front door. Now, that door is, we have accounts of people before the law office was built coming to this door to visit John Marshall for court cases.
Mm-hmm.
So the desk that we have there is actually John Marshall's desk. Faded quite a bit. It would have been much darker wood.
Would have been, I was going to say it's sort of a blonde looking. Now, I have to say, this is really cool. You are actually pulling the drawers out on the actual desk that John Marshall would have used in his front room. And, I mean, he obviously clearly touched this thing on many occasions. And
right.
I see the little pigeonhole storage areas in the drawers, the little ones. This is great.
Mm-hmm. And so this would have folded down all the way, which I'm not going to do.
But, sure.
And then it has the leather writing area.
Right. Very, very nice.
Yeah, and you can see how much darker that wood is.
Sure, on the inside, yeah. And I guess that's just because this is near a window?
Well,
sunlight?
It's been near windows for so long, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. But the cool thing about this is it's, if you look at the side panels, you don't see pieces of furniture that have a piece of solid wood as large as this. This is old growth, mm-hmm. Which is...
Oh, old growth wood, right. This came from a very large tree is what you're saying. Yeah, so a very wide plank. Okay, yeah, I see that. Okay. Not many of those trees left.
No.
And we don't typically cut them down for furniture anymore.
Exactly.
Got it. I'll have to wait a few hundred more years for that.
Yeah.
All right.
So in this room, we have a portrait of John Marshall above the fireplace. And mm-hmm. this is the last portrait that he ever sat for. It's a Hubbard. And
he was a good-looking fellow. And even in his, I guess he was getting close to 80 then.
Right,
nice
yeah.
square jaw, just very even features, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and, you know, when he was younger, his hair is kind of salt and pepper in this, but he had very dark hair, very dark eyes.
In that portrait, he still has all of his hair, at least he looks like it. Yeah, he was a lucky guy.
And so he's in his Supreme Court robes. Mm-hmm. And the black robes are actually something that pretty much came into fashion because of John Marshall. And the lack of the wigs also kind of to separate them.
British judges are, yeah, in fact, now that you mention it, they wore the wigs, and I think they wear red robes, don't they? It's mm-hmm. a general rule.
Exactly right.
I don't know that much about it, but that's my impression. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the black rose is kind of one of the things. And like I said, the lack of the wig is something that the Marshall did to kind of... It's the idea of the government of the people for the people.
Simple. Republican, yeah.
Right, yeah. We are not this separate above the law.
Right. That small R Republican, I'm not taking political sides. In fact, that was before the Republican Party was founded. I'm simply saying that when you said Republican in those days, you were differentiating yourself from monarchical forms of government. Mm-hmm. You know, we're more equal in this country, therefore our judiciary should be less ornate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
The other thing, the bookcase that we have here, this was a wedding present from the Ambler family. So John Marshall, when he married, we'll call her Polly because that's what he called her.
Right.
She was the daughter of Jacqueline Ambler. And Jacqueline Ambler was the treasurer of the colonies. And then after the United States won its independence, he became treasurer of Virginia. So he moved his family up here to Richmond from Yorktown.
Okay.
So this was from the Ambler family. And I would say more than half of the books in there have John Marshall's signature that these were his books.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Some of the changes before we move to the next room, obviously it's very difficult for the radio listeners to see, but I'll get you to take a look mm-hmm. up above this doorway.
Right.
And can you see what we call an architectural ghosting of an arch?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So keeping with that federal architectural style, there wouldn't have been a porch. You see a covered porch on the front now. Instead, we would have had, if you turn directly around, mm-hmm. the entrance would have been this fanlight and columns.
Oh, same sort of thing up mm-hmm. front. Okay, yeah, and that's very pretty, that the door between this room and the where we came mm-hmm. in has the fanlight and the arch over the top and the two right. pillars on either side.
And
yeah.
the keystone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see they made it fit. They had to cut a little bit off of the right-hand side in mm-hmm. order to fit it in there. One of the reasons that this is now inside instead of the front porch is that keystone.
And wait a second. This was taken from the front?
Yeah. This was right.
Oh, that was I didn't realize that. Okay, this was what was in the front, and they moved it when they put the porch on.
Mm-hmm.
Now I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Have you thought about moving it back?
No.
Why not?
Well, because this is a change that John Marshall had made during his lifetime.
Oh, okay. Excuse me. See, that's what I misunderstood. Yeah. Okay. In fact, that's an interesting aspect of all these historical houses. I mean, he lived here many years.
Right. He lived
so you got to pick an era. I mean, do you want the early house as he first had it, or you want it as he left it? And I guess you opted to have it as he left it.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. Because these colors in this room are done to when the house was completed in 1790.
But you left that there, and that's 1830 or whatever.
Right. This is about 1815. Is when
1815,
this happened.
Okay.
Yeah. And interestingly, I keep kind of bringing up that Keystone, and that's because John Marshall ended up becoming the Grand Master of his Masonic Lodge, the Randolph Lodge here in Richmond. In fact, the Randolph Lodge is the oldest continually operating Masonic Lodge in the United States.
That's remarkable. Yeah. George Washington was also a Mason.
Yes.
As were some of the other founders. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that means there's buried treasure here.
Oh.
That's what they say in those movies, right? That's right. I must be. Okay. All right. Back to reality. Right. So they moved that. Okay. So they have that. And so Marshall actually put that front porch on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is lovely. This looks also like a dining room.
Right. So we call this the family dining room. And it has built-in faces in the wall. I'll actually open this up
sure,
for
please.
You.
Sure,
And this is all original, but it's pronounced buffet. Mm-hmm. I guess normally we would say buffet, but it's the correct John Marshall period term was buffet.
It's very impressive. Now, what we're doing is we're looking at one of the shorter of the walls in a rectangular room, and it's where we have the fireplace. And above it, a portrait of Marshall in profile. And then you're pulling out some cabinets to the left of that are built right into the wall here. And inside of it, it's really very nicely set up.
Right. And we have a lot of the original Marshall Canton ware. So the Canton, it's export Chinese blue and white porcelain. That would have been their everyday service.
Real China, I mean from China.
Right.
Okay, that's where the name comes from, okay. Yeah.
These plates, Etienne Blanchard. And it's for those of you who care, it's blue cornflower pattern.
Mm-hmm. Very pretty.
But the service.
For the rest of you who don't know anything, it's a bunch of white plates. and then they got some glass stuff too. Yeah.
But this service was one of the things that John Marshall brought back from his time in France.
Okay.
And so the one and only time that John Marshall left the United States was to go attend some issues that were happening in France. Basically, France was attacking or privateering U.S. commerce ships.
This is let's just back up here. It's the 1790s. Mm-hmm. It's our first full decade of our new federal government.
Right.
It's only been less than 20 years since the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, our revolutionary partner, France, is acting in ways that we don't like much. In fact, so much so that we consider going to war with them. And many people will call this the quasi-war of the 1790s. And they were doing lots of things that people have heard the British doing, you know, taking our ships, interfering with our commerce. And it was during that period of tension that your story takes place. So
right.
Please pick up.
Well, during this period in France, this is the French Revolution has been going on.
Right.
And so you have what started out as kind of this more of like an Enlightenment kind of ideology that we want the government in France to be run more like the ideals of the United States, kind of a for the people government.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that what we're talking about is happening, it's a Directory period, and it's being run pretty much by Talleyrand.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this is part two, the second episode that we're devoting to a tour of John Marshall's historic home in Richmond, Virginia. John Marshall, the first great Chief Justice of the United States, and our tour is led by Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation, Virginia. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and continue the tour, so stick with us.
Marbury sued Madison in the Supreme Court, asked for an order telling Madison hand it over. Court of federal law, Congress and President passed, gave the court its power. Judiciary Act of 1789, to be exact. Now Chief Justice Marshall was in a tough place. If TJ ignored him, saying do it, the court would lose face. It was a war about turf, the court versus Polis the Smurf. The court's decision was laced with precision. The court said...
Well, it's a cold, cold day in Virginia, but I feel a warm glow has entered in here, and it's in the person of the besweatered quiz guy. His name is Doug. Doug Smith.
My name is Olaf, and I like warm hugs.
I am Olaf. No hugging. We'll see how you do, and then maybe I'll give you a hug.
I can tell you don't have kids that watch Frozen. The movie.
You're right. We missed Frozen by a few years, and I understand I'm kind of lucky.
Snowman. He says, my name is Olaf. I love warm hugs.
Okay. I don't like the way you're looking at me. So I'm going to see, is there anyone on the line?
Yes, I'm Jack from Richmond, Virginia.
Thanks for calling in, Jack. You sound kind of young. Are you a student type?
Yes, I'm a high schooler at the Center for Leadership, Government, Global Economics at Freeman High School.
My high school did not have a Center for Freedom and Economics, but that sounds very, very impressive. So, okay, well, we'd better find a hard question for this fellow.
Jack, I've got a question for you and then four answers for you to choose from. Are you ready?
All right.
Do you ever shop at Abercrombie? That's not the question. I'm just wondering.
I don't.
Okay, then you'll love this one. Here's the question. The EEOC, that's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, versus Abercrombie and Fitch case became before the Supreme Court recently. Samantha Eloff brought a case to the Supreme Court through the EEOC because the hipster clothing company did what?
Oh, man. The hipster clothing. Abercrombie.
Abercrombie and Fitch did what to Samantha Eloff, and it ended up in the Supreme Court? Is it A, Abercrombie & Fitch forgot to sweep snow from the front of the store? B, they fired Samantha Eloff for being late to work? C, they refused to hire Samantha Eloff for wearing a hijab or a headscarf? Or D, they fired Samantha Eloff for wearing nail polish.
Wow. Okay.
Case before the Supreme Court just recently, the EEOC on behalf of Samantha Eloff versus Abercrombie and Fitch, the hipster retailer, not frequented by Jack.
Any ideas, Jack?
All right. It's the headscarf, I believe.
Why do you immediately go to choice C, the headscarf?
I've read about it. I think it was argued, was it yesterday or sometime earlier in the week? I read a little bit of the arguments going on there.
Okay, wait, I'm trying to get my mind around this. You're a high school student, and you read about a Supreme Court case involving the EEOC and a hijab.
That is correct.
You're a high school student, and you weren't out just chasing girls and driving fast cars and doing things you're not supposed to do?
He was not shopping at Abercrombie
and
Fitch.
And he was not shopping at Abercrombie. You were reading about Supreme Court cases.
I was not shopping there. I was reading about their hiring practices, I suppose.
That is absolutely remarkable. And Doug?
He is absolutely right. Jack had nailed it on the head. Abercrombie and Fitch refused to hire a woman, Samantha Eloff, for wearing a hijab, that's a headscarf often worn by Muslim women, and made no bones about it that this is why they didn't hire her, because it does not comply with the look that they have for Abercrombie and Fitch employees, which they describe as East Coast collegiate. You can't wear nail polish, and you can't wear the color black if you work there either.
But that's not why they didn't hire her.
They hired her because she was wearing a hijab, a headscarf.
So they don't hire people who wear nail polish, but this was not the reason in this
case. That's right. That's right. And obviously the EEOC got involved and went to the Supreme Court, and the court has now heard this case. And, you know, Abercrombie & Fitch says essentially they have a look for their employees. It does not include a headscarf. And the employee, potential employee, never asked for religious accommodation. Therefore, they were in the right to not hire her. Blatant discrimination.
Wow, that's what they're arguing.
That's their argument.
Well, it's very interesting, of course. Employment law is a very, very complex area, and a lot of it's actually statutory rather than constitutional. The general rule, the starting point for most employment law, is that employers can hire or fire you for any reason. You're called an at-will employee in most cases, or no reason at all, unless there's a contract or a union contract or something of that sort that modifies it. On the other hand, there are some prohibited reasons for refusing to hire people or for firing people. And so that's another modification of the general at-will employee rule. It'll be interesting to see how this case comes out.
Absolutely. The Sikh community. So this is males wear turbans.
Uh-huh.
The Sikh community has been fighting this for years with the U.S. government. And now Sikhs may wear headscarves. They may wear their turbans in the military. And the military, the U.S. military, has had to make an accommodation because clearly this is a religious liberty issue.
Right, yeah. And the whole issue of religious liberties and religious freedoms emanates from the First Amendment, but it's been radically modified by something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But that's a whole nother conversation. But Jack, you nailed it. So you're going to get a YWC t-shirt, and you're going to get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. All you need to do is send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your shirt size and your mailing address, and we'll have those things in the mail to you.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. Well, and we appreciate you too, Doug.
Hey, thanks, Stuart. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
But no hugs.
No hugs.
You know what? If you get on the internet and you Google your weekly constitutional and you find our podcast, not only can you listen to parts of this episode that you might have missed, you know, when the kids started acting up or when you had to get out of the car, you can do that. And you can also listen to over 150 other archived episodes. And I guarantee there's at least one there that you will love. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm on a tour of the John Marshall House in Richmond, Virginia, guided by Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation Virginia. And we were talking about the house, and we were talking about the dining room, and we were talking about John Marshall himself. And it turns out that even before he became Chief Justice, he was intimately involved in the national affairs of our brand new country. So I think you're going to tell me about the XYZ affair,
right,
aren't
exactly.
you? Okay, please tell me.
Okay. So the XYZ affair, you have Eldridge Gerry, you have Charles Pinckney, and you have John Marshall. And they are sent to France to meet with Talleyrand and figure out a way to get the French ships to stop attacking American commerce ships. Upon arrival, what ends up happening is the French government wants the American government to pay bribes in order to have them stop attacking the ships, and over again in many
French.
Different
French people
in many different circumstances.
I knew it. Knew it had to be. Okay. All right.
The envoys from the United States just tell them that no, we're not paying these bribes. Mm-hmm. And so the talks, according to John Marshall, he believes that they have failed. They have not accomplished their mission. But when they arrive back in the United States, they're greeted to fanfare in the streets. They return home and they're basically considered heroes. And the reason that they're considered heroes is because they set the precedent saying that the United States does not take bribes. We would rather go to war than give you $1 in bribe money.
Well, good for you, John Marshall. I could see that. It's a young nation. We're proud, and we want to stand up for ourselves. Of course, it's very hard to stand up for yourself without a navy.
Right.
Which is another big issue that kind of takes us a little further forward into the John Adams era. But yeah, I mean, that was another huge issue, is that even once we had our federal constitution, you know, what are we going to do with it? And, you know, are we actually going to stand up for ourselves? And this was, the XYZ affair was one of those places where at least we refused to bribe them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think also France had, they finally did, you know, decide that they wanted to help America out towards the end and sent ships. And the French people.
You're talking about the Revolution.
Right.
Okay,
so during the United
yeah.
States, yeah, during the American Revolution, France helped us out, but it put them in a lot of debt.
Right.
And so it was the monarchy that helped us out. Strangely enough, the monarchy was helping people who were rebelling against the monarchy. But
then when they became a supposed republic, now we're at loggerheads with them. So go figure. Okay, just trust us. This happened. The 1790s, quasi-war, France, XYZ affair. Now you've heard it. Okay. And that was his one trip to France.
That was his one trip anywhere outside of the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. And he returns, and after he's greeted by, you know, adoring fans, he does go visit his wife who's staying in Winchester, and unfortunately she's not feeling very well, so she's kind of bedridden and recovering. But and let's see. So, but a few other things. We mentioned a couple of times John Marshall's love of Madeira. So there's no dinner setting that's really complete without a bottle of Madeira on the table.
Madeira, which was, we've done a whole episode of Madeira wine.
Did you?
Yes, we did, because it figures so prominently. So I'm going to short circuit it just briefly and say that if you're really interested in hearing about Madeira wine, look up our episode, our podcast. It's called The Mystery of Madeira Wine, and it's a fascinating tale. I'll just say for the record now that it was a very potent wine that did come from the island of Madeira off the coast, sort of the southern Europe, you know, northern Africa. I think it was a Portuguese possession at the time, and very, very popular among the founders, and Marshall was famous for supplying it, wasn't he?
Right. He loved it.
Yeah.
It survived really well on the trip. right. from Europe to the United States. In fact, while most wine cellars, you want to keep your Madeira really cool, mm-hmm. They say you can throw this in the attic in the middle of summer and it'll just taste better.
Yeah.
And it ages really well. So we have a couple of bottles that are dated around 1815 that still have the Madeira in them.
Wow.
Yeah. But right next to the table there's a box. It's on casters. It's got some beautifully inlaid wood on the mm-hmm. top of it. But we can go
yeah,
over here.
Yeah, let's go take a look. This is like my favorite thing in the whole house.
And when you open it up, it has space for 9 bottles of the Madeira.
This was his rolling party.
Right.
So he could just roll this big box behind him, and he's the guy who always brings the beer to the frat party.
Well, you know,
in this case, Madeira, but right. yeah.
Well, he was also famous for his punch. So in addition to having the lawyer's dinners where you would have very formal, formal with lots of Madeira, sit down dinners. He was also president of the barbecue club, or mm-hmm. also it was known as the Coit's Club in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And it was a gentleman's club. You had to pay a subscription every year and also be invited to it. So it was kind of you had to be somebody to be part of this. But what they would do, a lot of times they would host this at John Marshall's house here in Richmond. We had a lot more land back then. mm-hmm. And they would play a game called quoits. And quoits is similar to horseshoes. I like to say it's kind of half horseshoes, half croquet, mm-hmm. As far as the rules go. And instead of the throwing piece being a horseshoe, it's more like a donut-shaped. So it's a metal ring. But you still have your pegs, and you're trying to get as close to the peg as you possibly can. But you would do this at the barbecue club or the Coit's Club while drinking punch. Mm-hmm. And punch is not modern punch. You don't have champagne and some sort of fruit juice in mm-hmm. it. It's lemon, sugar, water, Madeira, brandy, and rum.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah. It's pretty potent stuff.
Okay. Jennifer, I want to pause here and say that what you've taught me today, okay, was that John Marshall was a barbecue-eating, hard-drinking, late-night partying judge who didn't always wear his pants on the bench. right?
You're pretty close to being right about that. Yeah, he has so many stories.
Uh-huh, right.
And it makes him so relatable.
Oh, absolutely. He was a regular fellow. And, of course, the constitutional relevance of this, at least what I've always understood it to be, is that... You know, even though he was Chief Justice, he was one of only, I think it was 7 members on the bench at that time, and he had to get a majority. Mm-hmm. And he was remarkably effective, not just in getting majorities, but often getting unanimous decisions
right.
for these extremely important early cases right. that were setting the basic direction of the country. And so it really is relevant. I mean, John Marshall wasn't just a brain trust. He wasn't just a fellow with a vision.
Right.
He was a guy who knew how to get it done,
yes.
and one of the ways to get it done was to have everybody over for dinner mm-hmm. and give them lots and lots of wine, and everybody loved everybody else, and the next day, whether because they were still feeling good or whether because they were hungover, they did what he wanted for the most part.
Right. Well, it didn't hurt that while the Supreme Court was in session in D.C., they all stayed at the same boarding house.
And that was at Marshall's insistence.
Right.
He really wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were lots of late-night discussions, which is so... foreign to, you know, the Supreme Court today.
Yeah.
The idea that we're all in a room together.
Yeah.
there's a joke that John Marshall would say. He would say that, you know, we can only drink if it's raining outside, you know. And so he would put his hand out the window and he would say, you know, it's not raining here, but our country is so vast that it has to be raining somewhere. So let's drink.
It's got to be past 5 o'clock somewhere.
I know.
That's right.
Yeah,
okay, got
yeah.
it.
That was John Marshall's It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very nice. And this is where a lot of that conviviality occurred, at least when he was in Richmond.
Right. So now we're going to go ahead and head upstairs.
Okay.
This is the original staircase, mm-hmm. So you know, feel free to touch the handrails that John Marshall touched.
Oh, I'm doing it right now. Man, that is exciting. Especially since nobody else has touched them in the intervening 200 years, I'm sure.
So
okay.
As important a man as John Marshall ends up being to... the United States' history. And the strength of this house, it's very, the mortars and the tenons are well crafted. It's a beautiful house, but it only has 3 bedrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And when we mentioned how many people were probably staying in this house.
It was a slumber party.
Right, pretty much. So this room is loosely interpreted as their daughter Mary's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
She was the only daughter that survived to adulthood. I can't imagine a night where she would ever have slept in this room alone.
Mm.
So because of that, we have a trundle bed in here kind of to represent that they would just pull other sleeping places out. And
you also have something under there that I'll point out. You have a chamber pot.
Right.
There was not a lot of privacy here. I mean, there wasn't.
Right.
Obviously, there's no indoor plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add that to the fact that people are in very close quarters with each other, they are engaging in all sorts of private activities in very non-private ways.
Yeah.
And so that was a very different lifestyle.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. This room has a couple of really neat things that I'd like to point out. It has the oldest artifact in the entire house.
Really? Which one?
And that's on this desk over here. This is a glazed stoneware inkwell that belonged to Thomas Marshall.
Wow.
So this was John Marshall's father's inkwell. And it survives, still here to this day.
Very impressive.
Yep. On the desk, we have Mary's, one of Mary's journals.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, what she's been doing in the journal is taking poetry or songs, phrases from books, and copying them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like a memento book. It's
right.
And probably a place where she practiced handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But it is neat to have her actual...
That's the actual book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the other really neat thing that we have in this room is an early pastel portrait of John Marshall's wife, Polly.
Oh.
And she's about 30
mm-hmm.
in this one. And you really get the... She's a small woman. In this portrait, she really looks very doe-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And from everything that we know about her, we have John Marshall's correspondence to her, but we don't have hers to him.
Hmm.
But we know by reading his letters that she was corresponding back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was answering questions that were in her letters. As was a pretty common tradition at the time, especially for political figures, upon her death, he burned all of her correspondence.
Mm, that's such a loss.
Yeah, it
mm-hmm.
really is. And they have a really great love story that I'll kind of touch on. So John Marshall, he's fighting in the Revolutionary War. He is furloughed. His father, Thomas Marshall, is stationed in Yorktown,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the Amblers are living at the time. So Thomas Marshall has really been talking up his son, John. He's got a lot of kids. He needs to marry them off. The Amblers are a really good family.
You should meet my son.
And, mm-hmm. and the Amblers have 4 daughters, so mm-hmm. how great is that?
Mm-hmm.
And so when John is furloughed, he's coming to Yorktown, and he absolutely has to meet this family, the Ambler family. So they throw a ball in honor of John Marshall coming to Yorktown. And so John Marshall comes to Yorktown, and he's been fighting in a war. He's not at all like what his father talked about him. He's not this distinguished gentleman. He's pretty much looks like a backwoodsman. You know,
mm-hmm.
his clothes don't fit. His hair is not brushed right. He hasn't shaved. You know, he doesn't have an iron.
mm-hmm.
And he also doesn't have the refined manners of this very upper-class Yorktown colonial family.
Mm-hmm.
So the 2 older daughters who originally were thinking that, you know, one of them was going to catch John Marshall's eye, they look at him and they basically say, "I was expecting an Adonis."
Mm-hmm.
And that is not what I found.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm on a tour of John Marshall's historic home in Richmond, Virginia. And it turns out that John Marshall was not just our greatest Chief Justice of the United States. He was also a real guy. And when he was a young man, he was interested in young women, like many young men are. And we were just hearing about an introduction where maybe his reputation was built up a little bit more than he himself could sustain. But don't worry. After the break, we'll talk about his success that followed very quickly upon that initial introduction. So stick around. And here's what I would normally refer to as our Madison Minute, courtesy of Jim Blaylock. But Jim had other ideas this week, so maybe we should call it something else.
Recently, I told Stuart that I had visited the site of the home of Charles Pinckney in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, and he encouraged me to do a Pinckney Minute. Charles Pinckney was one of two representatives from the state of South Carolina at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Charles Pinckney National Historic Site preserves a portion of Charles Pinckney's farm. Pinckney fought in the American Revolutionary War and became one of the principal framers of the United States Constitution, being one of the youngest in attendance. He served as governor of South Carolina and as a member of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives. He was also President Thomas Jefferson's minister to Spain after he helped Jefferson win the presidential campaign of 1800. The site was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1973 and is administered by Fort Sumter National Monument. With a Pinckney Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up our tour of the historic home of Chief Justice John Marshall in Richmond, Virginia, courtesy of Jennifer Hurst-Wender. Before the break, Jen was telling me about John Marshall's romantic intrigues as a young man.
And so Paula, at the time, she is, she's just turned 14, and she's smitten. So she arranges, she hasn't finished her dancing lesson, she has a note. They are not thinking that Polly is the girl for John. But she goes ahead and goes to the ball, and her and John dance the night away. So she's 14, and he has just celebrated his 24th. So he's almost 11 years older than she is.
11 years older than she is, and she's only 14.
Right.
Now, again, it's appropriate to say, at this point, we would look askance at that.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, much more common.
Right.
I mean, that was the destiny of a well-bred young lady. She was to be married mm-hmm. at some point. And if that happened a little bit earlier, then, right. you know, sometimes that worked out.
Well, it didn't happen immediately. Mm-hmm. They waited until she was 17.
Okay. Well, that's okay. That's right. A little more acceptable.
And during the intermediary, Marshall decides that, well, his father and mother had actually previously decided that John was going to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So they had given him lots of law books, English mm-hmm. common law, that sort of thing. And so he goes ahead and fulfills that prophecy. He goes to William and Mary and studies law. We have, there are in existence the law books that have in the, or his writing books in which he's scribbled Polly's name multiple times.
So he, okay, John Marshall goes to law school. And instead of listening to the lectures, I'm guessing by George Wythe, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Instead of listening to the very first law professor in the United States who's taught Jefferson and all mm-hmm. sorts of other prominent people, he's sitting there daydreaming about this girl.
Oh, yes.
Okay, that's my kind of law student.
Right.
Okay.
And so,
not that I ever did things like that. Never did things like that.
He's so human.
Yeah.
And so the family eventually moves to Yorktown, all the Amblers, or moves to Richmond, excuse me. So after the war is won, independence is gained, Jacqueline Ambler becomes the treasurer for the state of, or for the Commonwealth of Virginia, and his family moves here to the new capital in Richmond. And so John Marshall decides that Richmond would be a great place for him to practice law.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes on courting Polly. And so when she's 17, he finally asks for her hand in marriage. He's not the only suitor, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And she, for reasons unknown, says no.
Whoa!
Right.
Whoa! Was she just playing hard to get?
Maybe. And so, so Marshall is not the kind of guy that deals with somebody playing hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically packs up and he's like, you know, the only reason I was in Richmond is for you anyway. So he's going to leave the city. And she is so distraught that she cuts off a lock of her hair and she gives it to a cousin and says, please go give this to John Marshall or to John. He'll know what it means. And so the lock of hair is delivered, and apparently Marshall does know what it means. He goes back and asks her a second time, and she says yes. The thought is that we know that John Marshall is a really big fan of Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a
Alexander Pope.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's a story called The Rape of the Lock.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, there is a lock of hair that symbolizes Well, basically, I mean, the idea is that it symbolizes that I am yours. It is a love story. And so this lock of hair, now they're getting married, everything's
great. I'm glad I got the message because, you know, if somebody sent me a lock of hair, I wouldn't really know what to do with it. Okay, but different time. Got it? All right.
So he has that piece of hair braided into a beautiful Celtic knotwork and put into a gold locket, and he gives that to her as a wedding present. And she wears that until she is on her deathbed, and then she gives it to John. And then in his will, he writes that he wants that locket to be the very last thing that's taken off of his body.
Wow.
And we have it.
Where? Do I get to see it?
Yes, it's downstairs in a showcase. I'll show
it to
you.
All right, we'll see it.
So that's pretty much the story of John and Polly's courtship. She is like a lot of the founding fathers' wives. I mean, John Marshall's almost a founding father. He's maybe a founding son. She is pretty frail, but she lives a long time. And she has a couple of points where somebody is hired to come in and manage the household because she and manage her because she's not really able to do so. She doesn't go out into society after a certain point. She can't handle loud noises. She leaves the city every time there's a parade or a celebration or a lawyer's dinner. But the correspondence that we have shows that even though she was not going to deal with being out in society, that she still had a great deal of her wits about her, and it was pretty loving relationship that her and John had.
She just sounds like a politician's wife who had enough politics at a certain point. I mean, I know he wasn't an elected official, but he's a prominent, you know, public figure. And she just, at a certain point, says, you know, honey, I'm just not doing this anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting because John Marshall is such a congenial man. He loves to party. He loves the celebrations. And then he has this quiet side with his wife. So it's almost like his introversion belongs to her. And he can just be quiet and relaxed and read with her or talk about, you know, have a very civil discourse with her.
Reminds me of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, at least early in their marriage, before they became estranged. And I think Eleanor was much more the quiet type and appealed to that part of Roosevelt. But he, like Marshall, was very much the party animal.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm probably not the first person to notice that parallel. But yeah, that's okay. That's very interesting.
So we'll go to the last room on the tour. This is John and Polly's bedchamber.
Mm-hmm.
It's unusually wallpapered. Normally, you don't see a second floor with wallpaper. And this was most likely done because this was where Polly spent probably the last 30 years of her life.
Mm.
She was very reclusive and ill for the last 30 years. Just
in this one room, basically.
Pretty much. This was her. This was where she lived, resided, took her meals, did everything. So I'm sure that the wallpaper is kind of just a tribute to her. In this room, we have her sampler by the bed. That was something that she did when she was 8 or 9 years old in Yorktown.
At the bottom, it says Mary Ambler.
Right. at the foot of the bed is a worn leather satchel with some needlework on it. And this family history has said that this was the traveling bag that Marshall would take when he was serving on the circuit court. So this would travel with him to Raleigh on a regular basis. We have written on top of John Marshall's traveling desk, we have the U.S. Constitution.
Article 3, right, Section 3,
right.
The treason definition.
Yeah.
And, of course, the relevance of that is...
Well, Marshall was the judge that tried the Aaron Burr treason trial.
Huge, huge issue. A couple things to explain. First of all, treason, I believe, is the only crime that's defined in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it's very brief. I'll just read it right off of your thing here. It says, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. That's typically read as being a very, very tough to achieve definition. It's a very tough crime to convict somebody of because the concept of treason had been abused by so many tyrants throughout history, and they didn't want that to happen in the United States. But Aaron Burr was tried for treason, and I'll simply say that we did a whole episode simply called Aaron Burr's Big Adventure, I think. One other point of explanation, you mentioned John Marshall rode circuit. Well, at that time, Supreme Court justices served only for part of the year as the Supreme Court. But then the rest of the year, sort of strangely, they would go out and serve as trial judges, riding from place to place in a big loop that was called a circuit. And that's what you meant by riding circuit.
Right.
And it was in that strange role as a trial judge that he was trying the treason case against Aaron Burr. I think he was doing it right here in Richmond, though,
yes.
Wasn't he? Okay.
Yes.
So that's a huge part of the John Marshall story. What are the highlights?
Well, let's see. Basically, Thomas Jefferson really wanted to convict Aaron Burr. He'd pretty much already said he's guilty of treason.
Right.
So
he's gone out west and he was fomenting rebellion against the United States.
Right.
He was going to go out there and mess with the Spanish,
right,
and
exactly,
all that sort of stuff.
Levying war with Spain, but he also wanted to break apart and become emperor of his own little area of the
western part,
right,
like over by Louisiana,
yeah,
or down in that area. That was the basic allegation. This, of course, was all after the infamous duel with Alexander Hamilton. So, I mean, Burr was, I'm serious, you need to listen to that other episode, because he did some freaky stuff late in his life, and that was what prompted this trial. Okay.
But the crazy thing is in Richmond, he was considered almost a superstar. I mean, women were bringing their unmarried daughters
Aaron Burr.
To him. Yes, and bringing him food, and I mean, everybody, there was a really big support for Aaron Burr in Richmond. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, see,
you did
show me something I didn't know.
Yeah.
So this was like the trial of the century.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yes. It was one of these things where the courthouse was packed, all of the hotels were packed, because people were traveling to come and see this event.
Right.
Yeah. And there's also another really interesting story that we've mentioned previously, John Wickham.
Mm-hmm.
There is a time Wickham is defending Burr, and Burr is invited to Wickham's house, but nobody told Marshall, or so we think nobody told Marshall, but he was also invited to that party. So you have a dinner party in which the judge and the accused and the defending lawyer were all at the same dinner party.
Wow.
The other person who was at that dinner party is Washington Irving, the Sleepy Hollow fame. He is a writer for a newspaper, I think in New York, and he writes this scathing article about John Marshall and how he's been bought, and by the end of the case, John Marshall's being burned in effigy around the nation.
Well, I know that Thomas Jefferson was doing all sorts of inappropriate things during this trial. He was trying very, very hard to influence the outcome. But just for the benefit of our listeners, what was the outcome? What happened?
They couldn't prove that Burr was committing treason.
Right.
So it's not that they found him innocent of it. They found that they couldn't convict him of it.
And that goes right back to the constitutional language that we talked about. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act, or on confession in open court. That's an extremely high bar.
Yeah.
So maybe Burr was doing some freaky stuff out there that maybe could have qualified as making war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, but they didn't have enough evidence to convict him.
Right.
So the Constitution worked.
Right. And then there's also the fact that Thomas Jefferson wanted to just, I'm the president, I say he committed treason, and that was struck down, that the president is not above the law.
Right. Very important.
Right. So that's the other. So there's two parts to the Aaron Burr trial that we still see today.
Tremendous. Well, let's, again, just listen to the podcast. It's called Aaron Burr's Big Adventure, if you're interested in that. But that is, of course, John Marshall played a pivotal role in
as
a trial judge.
Right.
Okay.
So I guess for time's sake, we'll go ahead and...
Okay, we've hit most of the highlights. Let's walk downstairs. I want to see that locket before we go, or anything else that's down in the basement that you want to show me. Yeah, I'm sorry I have to rush off. I'm doing some filming for Montpelier today over at a studio on 20th Street, and that was my excuse for coming over here today.
Okay.
But I do need to get over there by...
Wash your head again.
Oh, I washed my head. Here we go. Okay, here we are down in the basement where we came in again. We're going to end up here, and Jennifer is going to tell me about the locket.
Okay, so in the center in the showcase, we have this gold locket. And you can see it's a medallion shaped. You open it up, and we have a photograph above it.
Oh, well, what's in it? Okay.
And you can see the Celtic knotworked hair, and there's a crystal on top of it. So it just opens up, and that's that famous lock of hair. Also in the showcase, we have some more hair jewelry. This has a bit of John's hair, a little bit of Holly's, and a little bit of their firstborn son's.
Oh, that's so nice.
And then...
Now, this one I want you to tell me about, because I remember this from the last time I visited here. This is one of the coolest things. Go on, please.
So this is a handwritten letter from George Washington to John Marshall. It's asking John Marshall to be the Attorney General.
In the Washington administration.
Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. This is 1795. And John Marshall refuses. He doesn't accept. But the letter itself, actually, it says, "Don't tell anybody I asked you if you say no."
Well, that makes sense. You don't want people to know they were your second choice or
right,
your third
yeah,
choice.
Exactly. But here it is for anybody who visits the John Marshall
House. Now they all know, but at least there's no one alive who's going to be upset about that. But when I first saw that, I laughed out loud because can you imagine turning down George Washington?
He turned down George Washington a number of times for different positions. Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, well, he loved Richmond, and he didn't want to go up to D.C. Mm-hmm. So any appointment that, or if he was asked to be an ambassador to France at one point, mm-hmm. This is previous to the XYZ affair, and he said no to that. He was asked to be the Secretary of War, and he said no to that.
It took John Adams first to make him Attorney General, mm-hmm. and then to elevate him to the Chief Justiceship in a whole... lengthy story that I've talked about in an episode, I think it's called Who Made You the Boss is the title of it, and it's all about Marbury versus Madison, which was the first major remarkable mm-hmm. case that John Marshall decided. So again, if you want to hear about Marbury and judicial review and embark upon a whole journey about why Marshall was so important, you're going to have to listen to another one because we just don't have time in this episode. This was about his house and about his personal life. And Jennifer, thank you so very much for taking the time to tell us all about this.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Before we go, how can people find you on the internet?
Okay, so since the John Marshall House is a Preservation Virginia site, if you go to preservationvirginia.org and then go to visit, you'll mm-hmm. be able to see links to the John Marshall House and all of our other properties that we manage.
And I'm sure you can also make donations there.
Yes.
For this extremely important historical preservation ongoing project.
Yes. Also, we have a Facebook page, mm-hmm. so there's that way, too. We also have a pretty rigorous event schedule. So if you want to, we have speakers. We have chocolate and wine events in the spirit of John Marshall. So if you're local or want to make the drive, I highly recommend checking out our special
events. I recommend it even if you're not local. I drove 7 hours to get here, so you can, too. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation Virginia for that wonderful tour of the John Marshall House in Richmond, Virginia, which took up not one but two episodes. So if you missed the first episode, go back on our podcast site or go back on iTunes and find it. It's called A Visit to John Marshall House, Parts 1 and 2. Hey, you know what? If you want a copy of this or other episodes of Your Weekly Constitutional, get on the internet and Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional, and listen to over 150 podcasts. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute, or this week, our Pinckney Minute, is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. Thank you, Jim. That was a cool perspective today. And my name is Stuart Harris. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.